name is Kathy Finley, and as I disclaimed the first day, I don't feel like an expert in this area, but I feel like it's been a real privilege to take a look at some of the questions surrounding work as I prepared for this, and today especially, as I guess Tuesday was, is going to be a chance to really have a conversation, I hope, about the challenges and temptations involved in whatever form work takes for us. Yesterday we took a look at some attitudes toward work in scripture and history, and nearly ran out of time because there's so much to say there. But the first thing I'd like to do, as we have done other days, is to do this litany of work. And I have copies here. We don't need the copies to pray with them, but you're welcome to take a copy if you'd like. Don't let me forget at the end of the time to invite you, if you'd like to come tomorrow, to bring some something along with you, which I'll explain later. So if we can collect ourselves for a moment, and the response to the litany of work is up there on the board. We praise you, God.
We give thanks, O God, for the work of our lives.
We praise you, God.
For the work of our hands.
We praise you, God.
For the work of our minds.
We praise you, God.
For the work of our hearts.
We praise you, God.
For the enlightening work of teachers, librarians, students, and coaches.
We praise you, God.
For the healing work of doctors, nurses, and counselors.
We praise you, God.
For the creative work of artists, musicians, painters, and sculptors.
We praise you, God.
For the precise work of engineers, scientists, and computer scientists.
We praise you, God.
For the nurturing work of homemakers, parents, and guardians.
We praise you, God.
For the wise work of retirees and grandparents.
We praise you, God.
For the proclaiming work of writers, photographers, editors, and publishers.
We praise you, God.
For the trustworthy work of accountants, bankers, lawyers, politicians, and salespeople.
We praise you, God.
For the faith-filled work of the ordained religious and lay ministers.
We praise you, God.
For the protective work of police and firemen and military personnel.
We praise you, God.
For the dedicated work of secretaries, receptionists, and bookkeepers.
We praise you, God.
For the compassionate work of volunteers.
We praise you, God.
For the judicious work of managers, administrators, directors, and supervisors.
We praise you, God.
For the fruitful work of farmers, fishers, growers, and gardeners.
We praise you, God.
For the steadfast work of those who manufacture products.
We praise you, God.
For the constructive work of builders, surveyors, architects, masons, and carpenters.
We praise you, God.
For the effective work of those who transport people and things by bus, plane, train, taxi, truck, and boat.
We praise you, God.
For the hospitable work of cooks, waiters, waitresses, cashiers, hotel, and motel workers.
We praise you, God.
For the clarifying work of television, radio, and news media workers.
We praise you, God.
For the dependable work of the telephone and postal workers.
We praise you, God.
For the good work of all the other workers.
We praise you, God.
For our work which sheds light on the darkness.
We praise you, God.
For our work which creates order from chaos.
We praise you, God.
For our work which builds peace out of hostility.
We praise you, God.
For our work which helps others.
We praise you, God.
For our work which serves others.
We praise you, God.
For our work which empowers others.
We praise you, God.
For our work which inspires others.
We praise you, God.
For our work which builds your kingdom.
We praise you, God.
Thank you. Nicely read. For those of you coming in just now, this litany of work is something that we've begun all of the sessions so far with, and will again tomorrow. And you're welcome to a copy of that prayer if you would like. There are some copies here. And I have a couple of images that I've mentioned a time or two during the week that I liked talking about work and the importance. The bottom image, if you can't see it, says, which of these workers spent the last 8 hours building the kingdom of God? So just some things to make us think about. And our topic today, as I mentioned, is the challenges and temptations involved in work, looking at questions of evil and sin and so on as it may reveal itself in work. This is a little bit a different direction, but it's something. It's a story that I thought was really interesting. It's actually excerpted from Studs Terkel's book *Working*, which is over in the bookstore. This is a woman, Dolores Dante, a waitress who refuses to be demeaned. So, in a sense, that's one place where she hits evil in her life, and it's just an intriguing story. This is what she says: I have to be a waitress. How else can I learn about people? How else does the world come to me? I can't go to everyone, so they have to come to me. Everybody wants to eat. Everyone has hunger, and I serve them. If they've had a bad day, I nurse them, cajole them. Maybe with coffee, I give them a little philosophy. They have cocktails. I give them political science. I can't be servile. I give service. There is a difference. I'm called by my first name. I like my name. I hate to be called Miss. Even when I serve a lady, a strange woman, I will not say Madam. I will say, I hate Ma'am. I always say M'lady. Interesting. It would be very tiring if I had to say, would you like a cocktail? And say that over and over. So I come out different for my own enjoyment. I would say, what's exciting at the bar that I can offer? I can't say, do you want coffee? Maybe I'll say, are you in the mood for coffee? Or the coffee sounds exciting. Just rephrase it enough to make it interesting for me. That would make them take an interest. It becomes theatrical and I feel like Mata Hari and it intoxicates me. When somebody says to me, you're great, how come you're just a waitress? Just a waitress. I'd say, why, don't you think you deserve to be served by me? I don't feel lowly at all. I myself feel sure. I don't want to change the job. I love it. I tell everyone I'm a waitress and I'm proud of it. If a nurse gives service, I say you're a professional. Whatever you do, be a professional. So she's hit some issues of temptation or evil in her life and has decided how she's going to handle those. The topic that we want to look at ties in a bit with some of the things I was suggesting yesterday about how work can be important, and yet we need to acknowledge its limitations. Work sustains people, helps them to make payments on homes, to provide for security and education of their families, to reach out to the poor and forgotten in society. It can help us to develop intellectually, psychologically, and spiritually. But it is not meant to be everything. It is not meant to be obsessive or addictive. It is not meant to replace the true God with the gods of success, ambition, honor, recognition, or power. Unless work is united with prayer, in which false gods are often discovered, and leisure, it can lead to burnout, despair, and certainly little, if any, gratitude. So that's where prayers, we'll talk about later, meditation, and spirituality have a role in helping us balance our attitude toward work. These are all goodies I gleaned from here and there that I just wanted to share with you. Yesterday, we ended up talking about Pope John Paul II's letter on human work. The technical title is Laborum Exercens, which usually these documents take the first two or three words in Latin. And I mentioned that on the one hand, Pope John Paul says that work is a sharing in the creative activity of God. On the other hand, work is toil and suffering, pain and sweat. And he suggests that we may be talking about looking at the cross and the mystery of the cross in our lives, as well as the mystery of the resurrection. And so we'll come back to that in just a little bit. And related to that, which I just want to toss this out as a topic we want to discuss a bit, I hope too, is workaholism, a person who compulsively seeks escape through work. And the comment is made in this chapter on spirituality of work, which I grabbed out of a book I'm using for another class that I'm teaching, comments that Jesus was not a workaholic, that Jesus didn't, you know, work compulsively, but we see Jesus often at rest and often at prayer, and has a good balance in his own life. So we may come back to the question of workaholism. What kinds of attitudes do you see toward work on bumper stickers? Let's start there. I mentioned yesterday, I owe, and off to work I go. You know that one?
Drudgery is often what we see on bumper stickers.
Uh-huh. Can you think of any specifically?
Or stay efficient. Better than that.
Yeah, uh-huh. Or I'd rather be sailing, skiing, whatever. Thank God it's Friday. They mention go ahead.
One, I don't know if it's a bumper sticker, but there's a little sign right on the door for the tape room.
Yeah.
It says, Jesus is coming, look busy.
Yeah.
It looks like we're doing something.
Yeah.
We have to work to do.
Really.
You know, it's like we're not supposed to just be able to sit and be idle.
Yeah, well, I think Lutherans have the equivalent, but Catholics are real good at guilt. I think that's a good example. Lutheran guilt, Catholic guilt, I don't know.
It's all the same.
Yeah, it's all the same.
Another one that talks about, I can't remember the exact wording, but winner is the one that dies with the most toys or something.
Yeah,
like that.
The one that dies with the most toys wins, something like that, yeah. Right, good point. They mention a couple other ones here. I fight poverty, I work.
Yeah.
Or get a life. You know, what do you hear in most of those bumper stickers?
Work is a necessary evil, mm-hmm. as opposed to being something that you add into joyful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. with almost the emphasis on evil rather than necessary. Even you know, it's just let's put up with this,
kind of
hold our noses till the weekend or whatever. Yeah, yeah. Okay, this is an interesting quote. See what you think of this. The workplaces of America are full of Pharisees, people often well-meaning whose vision of the gospel is obstructed by their loyalty to the religion of their craft, their work. Make no mistake, the workplace is this nation's great unrecognized church. Each workplace, each profession has its own culture, its own set of values. They are largely unexamined, but they are relentlessly inculcated, relentlessly enforced. For many, this religion is more persuasive, more powerful than anything they observe on Sunday. It can become the false god we place before the real one. What do you think? The source, by the way, is a... Oh, I guess it's out of Human Hands. Now, is that the part that I was going to read? I think it is part of... How about that? Yeah, that's exactly the quote I had marked in here as well. This is one of the books that I've suggested for the class that's in the bookstore. He's a newspaper editor of the paper in Easton, Pennsylvania. Is that too strong of an assessment?
I don't think so. There's another book called The Soul of the Law,
mm-hmm.
and I worked in that area.
Yeah.
And so this guy did like a survey of people in groups like this, asked them to write down all the characteristics of a lawyer, of law, if you looked at them. And so one characteristic that never came up was love.
And were these people lawyers that were writing this?
No, these are just general audience. And what they were given was a scenario, imagine you're a counselor. It's an easy afternoon. Somebody walks in and says, I'd like to sit and talk. Could I do that? And he says, sure. And the person says, what's your name? And the person says, I'm your lawyer. And they ask him all these questions. Well, the characteristic that was never put down in thousands of interviews was love. And so I've talked to other lawyers about that. And most of them have said, yes, so. You know?
It doesn't break my heart.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, well, what happens once you get in your car and you're leaving your home? Right? You turn off love, and then when you come back home, you turn it back on. But in the workplace, these people would suggest that lawyers don't love. And, you know, I mean, so I think we are shaped mm-hmm. by the process, the jailer who goes in to deal with those burdens, you know, because I do that, you know. I mean, they're people,
mm-hmm.
but they have anger
mm-hmm.
doing their job.
And some of those attitudes perhaps become formed in, say, law school in your profession? Or does it switch
thing.
On?
Yeah. Because we're not taught compassion, you know.
Yeah.
Just give me the logic. pay enough fees and I'll get you off, you know, that's another thing. But,
yeah.
But yeah, we're not taught to love, right? And the criminal justice system is not taught to love. And I think that's a part of a religion, of my religion is to love.
Sure. Well, and my question too would be, how much of that may be reinforced when you were talking about the legal profession? I kept thinking of all the lawyers' jokes, you know. It's like, so is there an us and them mentality that just gets strengthened by the lawyer jokes, perhaps?
You talk about being dispassionate and impartial. And so it's not logical.
Yeah.
And I think in a religion or a structure or people being together, we would talk about love being an important component of it. Yet there's a significant aspect of our society that says this will not be part of it. We will not love you. We will impartially judge you.
Yeah. How does that translate into other professions? In your personal experience or what you've observed?
In, you know, the medical profession, when you have medical students, and especially in psychotherapy, when you're doing that, they say, well, you're taught. They'll come up to me and say, oh, I think I just cared too much and I got involved with this patient and they were able to con me, maybe an alcoholic or something like this. And then, you know, you have to stop and say, whoa, wait a minute. You don't want to say that you cared too much. You were maybe caring more for yourself than for the individual in whatever you wanted to transmit. So we just, and it says if you don't care, you ought not to be in the profession.
Yeah.
Okay, and so let's sort of make that clear. But we do have a misconception that sometimes when we give too much energy to something, that it's not appropriate because we lose objectivity with it. Sometimes we're asked to lose objectivity because we have a human person in front of us, and that's what we're trying to address rather than just something technical.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mixed, mm-hmm. a lot of mixed kinds of things.
Hmm. Any thoughts? I know I had some questions. I have a degree in counseling, psychology, and during my internship, found some real tensions in the business of how much to care and when to have a clear clinical distance, but not in the sense of not caring, but of not getting over involved in the client's issues. And I found it not something that I could carry off easily. Mm-hmm. And I really had difficulty with the seemed to be the increasing trend in counseling of the diagnostic model, the DSM-3 and all that, and now DSM-4, I guess, but the insurance companies, I don't mean to talk jargon here, which is interesting. Jargon is one of those ways that we do tend to wall off the profession, I think. But the insurance companies, when coverage is given for something like counseling or psychological work, and insist on some kind of a diagnosis, very medical model. And, you know, my question was, who am I to be diagnosing this person? But it was an assumption that was part of that profession, that if I was going to continue into that profession, I needed to buy into, you know, or agree with in the main that approach. And I couldn't do it. It was not an approach.
I think a lot of times people go into a profession with an ideology about how they are going to serve or help.
Idealism?
Yes.
Okay.
And that they are going, for instance, someone who wants to be a lawyer mm-hmm. because they're going to seek justice for mm-hmm. humanity,
mm-hmm.
and regardless of what the profession is. And you get into it and discover that there are a lot of roadblocks to fulfilling that ideology,
mm-hmm.
and disappointments set in. And mm-hmm. then, out of necessity, the person's goal has to change as to get the originally thought when they
show
us the profession.
I'm curious about if we could identify some of those roadblocks, as you name them, that may cross over one profession to another that can get in the way of really why we may have gotten into what we're about. And again, this may not be your, it may be your personal experience or others that you've seen. What kinds of things could we name as roadblocks?
Pure cynicism.
Okay, good.
Bureaucracy.
Thank you. So that could take any of a number of forms. It might be a lot of forms and papers to fill out, or others to report to.
Organizational conversion.
Good. Boy, we get some great words up here. What else?
Office politics.
Which is related to but different from the bureaucracy.
Money. Economics, huh?
Yeah.
For me, I've hit a number of times in my work experience what I name as a lack of vision, and that will take a variety of forms, but part of it has to do with a lack of willingness to take risks and to, to do the what-ifs and so on. I was in one situation one time on a team working actually in campus ministry, and I get my energy from ideas, and you can probably tell that. But I was told as a member of this team, finally, when they couldn't take it anymore, we have more than enough to do already. We don't need any more possibilities. And it was finally clear as a bell to me, oh, I can't be here anymore, you know. But it's related to the we've always done it this way, or, you know, however that takes shape. Anything else you want to add to our list here?
I don't know how to put it into words, but I went off and worked on an Indian reservation, and I thought, well, I'm going to do some good things. I couldn't overcome the population I thought I was going to serve. It's like, you know, like I'm thinking of a school teacher who says, I'm going to go to the inner city and really teach these kids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, good luck, you know. So, because they're worried about being fed in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure how to say it.
So it has to do with the environment in which one is working, and
environmental realities, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. There may be enough givens in a situation that prevent, with all the best intentions and the best energies in the world, the kind of movement that you expect. Yeah, that's been my experience as well. Good. Excellent.
You know, if you want to put it on a personal basis, too, it's our difficulty in being able to focus on a call or a mission in the work. Because even in the world, no matter where we are, there are all these kinds of forces against us. Somehow we can resist that, or we think we should resist that in the world and think about it a different way. Sometimes we don't do that in the workplace. We view ourselves as employees. We view ourselves as other kinds of things, and then it decreases, and there has to be an environment at work that allows that kind of spirit, but then there also has to be that spirit within the individual that has that vision, that makes a decision of whether they want to be there, or whether they want to move on to something else, or whether they want to buck the system or change it.
Mm-hmm. And what I hear you saying is that a lot of the time we don't allow ourselves to be empowered in that situation, right, to really ask those questions. Why? I've got to have a job. I got to have the money. And, you know, what'll happen if I lose this one, especially if I figure the economy or the market for my particular profession or whatever is tight? I can't rock the boat.
Well, I think it's a power issue, too.
Yes.
It's the issue with power.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Employee power, it's hierarchical, and it becomes, it's not a conducive area. Most employers don't, like in your situation, don't want to hear anything more.
Yeah.
They want to be able to have that decision or have the vision and then pass it down, mm-hmm, rather than see it.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't power in an individual's, mm-hmm, sense in my situation. Finally, the spiritual director I was working with at the time pointed out to me that I was an idea person who was working with maintenance people.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was a threat to their maintenance, and I was getting nowhere with my ideas. It was so helpful to finally have that pointed out. There are several kinds of hazards or problems that, in the introduction to Studs Terkel's book, Working, that he talks about that I'd like to kind of throw into the mix here for a minute, and I'll try not to read too much at you. But one of them has to do with the automation of jobs and the fact that that leads, he says, to a questioning of the typical work ethic. If I just, you know, work hard, I'll succeed, and so on. But he also puts that together with the put down of craftsmanship. A farm equipment worker in Moline complains that the careless worker who turns out more that is bad is better regarded than the careful craftsman that turns out less that is good. I don't know if you have examples related to that. I can think of a friend of ours who used to be a cabinet maker, and gosh, he was an excellent cabinet maker. Loved doing it, but couldn't afford to keep making the quality of stuff that he was making. Went back to school as a nurse, as ended up working in nursing, and he's a good nurse, but he was an outstanding cabinet maker, but it wasn't financially feasible for him to do that. If you have other examples, feel free to jump in. Another thing that he points out is it's very vivid the way he describes it here. He says some of the older workers that he talked to were talking about what they'd been doing, and he said he was watching people's hands. Among the many, though, the words and phrases came, some heatedly, others coolly. The hands were at rest, motionless. In some cases, there was a caressing almost of what they had been working on, or as they were talking about things. He said, the hands were at rest, motionless, their eyes were something else again. As they talked of their jobs, it was as though it had little to do with their felt lives. It was an alien matter. At times, I imagined I was on the estate of Dr. Caligari, and the guests poured out fantasies. He said there was this dissociation from their work. Something switched off in them, even talking about their work, let alone being there. That's a significant problem. Another issue he brings up is planned obsolescence. And I know this feels grim, but I think it's important for us to name these. The planned obsolescence that is of a piece with the planned obsolescence of the things that people make or sell. It is perhaps this fear of no longer being needed in a world of needless things that most clearly spells out the unnaturalness, the surreality of much that is called work today. You know, if we're changing our thinking machines, our computers, what, every couple of years anymore? You know, what does that portend for the rest of us? Interesting comment toward the end of the introduction. Nora Watson may have said it most succinctly. I think most of us are looking for a calling, not a job. Most of us, like the assembly line worker, have jobs that are too small for our spirit. Mm-hmm. That's a great phrase. Jobs are not big enough for people. Do you think that's changing, or do you think that that's pretty accurate?
Okay. I'm not sure as a society, but in communities where industries are being lost, and you hear in the timber areas, you hear somebody saying, "Well, you know, I worked 23 years on the wood line, and you know, made a lot of money. But what am I going to do now?"
Can everybody hear Terry?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Speak up just a bit.
I'm talking about people like in industries that are being lost, like the timber industry.
Right.
And so they've been making good wages for a long period of time, but now the mill's closing. They have no idea what to do. And I've often reflected, well, you're making such a high wage. Why didn't you invest some of that into learning other skills? But for reasons of their own, they didn't. And now they're 47, and we just had a plywood plant close. And all the guy knew is something about glue mixing. And what is he going to do now? So he's going to college, but he doesn't know what to do. I think you got sucked into the thing of, I'm making money, that's all I need to do. And when that goes away, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, and that is a real shift in terms of the patterns of work from in the past, because that was all that was required when you stepped into that, you know, trade, was to, you know, do what the boss said and, you know, make sure you follow the norms of what the job involves, and we're changing the rules on people. And that's really pretty disorienting, pretty distressing.
And for most people, I think they get locked into that mindset and can't think their way or train their way into another one. It's a great challenge.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I would be any easier to do it myself if I was in that place.
Yeah. My sister is involved in some job retraining. She actually took early retirement from the telephone company because that industry is changing some as well. And she was a telephone company operator. I mentioned her, I think, the other day. But she's been, it's in a job retraining with a lot of people from the timber industry and so on. And I've watched her whole life change in the last couple of years as she does that education. You were going
to
jump
in. His friend at the glue factory, he said he did not do anything to train himself. If he had started to get an education, I think he would have had to quit his glue factory job after he had enough education. So in order to stay there, he had to be careful not to be retrained.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it would almost be.
Also, I think some of the idea of job retraining is a lot easier in an urban rather than in a rural area. And there are a lot of rural jobs, such as your lumbering industry and farming, and a lot of those things, to be retrained in something, for many it means leaving where they're living, selling their home, and if it's a depressed area, who wants to buy it? I mean, there are a lot of factors that enter in to retraining, and it's kind of dead end. I mean, they're between a rock and a hard place.
Yep. It's really a scary process.
Maybe another word you have to put up there is fear, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Roadblocks, huh?
Yeah.
And anxiety about what the future holds and ability to change, huh?
Mm-hmm. What would something else look like? I know what this is, but I don't know what something else will look like and what all the implications for that might be.
And there's some denial in that too. Some people think, I know the job is going to be terminated in X amount of years, because when you're working in a job like that, you know by the atmosphere you're in.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to do anything until it actually happens to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll think about all those problems instead of saying, I know this is going to happen. What are my options? And what can I start doing to change my attitude of looking for something different instead of saying, no, I'm going to be a diehard, I'm going to stay in this until everything's cut off or I'm hanging. And a lot of people do that.
That's one scenario. As you were talking, I was thinking about, I work with engaged couples, and I was working with a couple of folks roughly my age, mid-40s to early 50s, and the guy just in the past couple of weeks had lost his job. And it was not foreseen by anybody, but I mean, he could finally see it before he got called into the boss's office, sort of thing. But here he is, you know, with teenage kids to raise and a new, marriage on the way, and he can't do what he was doing before. And there's a lot of that happening that isn't maybe industry specific in ways that could be foreseen, and that has some real problems to it as well. The scenario, which I don't know about your parents, but I know with my parents, my father worked for the telephone company all the time. He was we were raised, and he did two or three different jobs in there. But the prospect of staying with one company lifelong is pretty unusual anymore.
I think you're now talking about six or seven changes for people that are just going into the job market now.
Yeah. What are some of the kinds of typical temptations that might happen in a job situation? Let's go to more the individual now instead of the work environment, to just try and see what kinds of things happen in a work setting that could be potentially destructive. Yes?
I think that as, you know, average jobs are now less than 5 years, we see downsizings and layoffs and early retirement programs, whole industries going through change, What I have observed is that individuals cease being loyal at all to their organizations. There's just no loyalty to the company, and what gets produced out of that is an attitude of selfishness that, you know, I might as well just be out for myself because I don't trust the organization. And it really becomes irrational. I work for a company where our total employee base is growing 40% a year, and there's one little division where there's some uncertainty about if we're going to keep doing that one thing. And there's five people involved in a company of 800. And if you talk to anybody who knows that five people, our entire company is evil because they have no job security.
It's the fear thing. Yeah.
It's very difficult. It's difficult to manage because companies are now cycling back to saying, gee, you know, retention of employees is a good thing, even though, on the other hand, we have a bunch of practices that involve getting rid of people when they get too expensive or controlling their salaries. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to have a bell-shaped curve where the average raise in your department can't be any more than 3.5%. So if you have one good employee, you have to find two other people that you're going to let go so that you can keep the one person. Mm-hmm. It is a challenge.
Yeah, it is. So that lack of loyalty is something that you've experienced to really be a potentially poisoning influence in terms of the larger group of employees. What else? How about gossip? Not unique to the workplace, but I think something that can, it's related sort of to your loyalty point.
Dishonesty.
Can you give an example or say more about that?
Well, you know, putting the hand in the till and embezzling, or even doing a poor job is really dishonest.
Good point. I'm just finding a quote from Martin Luther that I had in my goodies to share with you. He said, "To steal is nothing else than to acquire another's property by unjust means. People steal not only when they rob another's strong box or pocket, but also when they take advantage of their neighbor at the market, in a grocery shop, butcher stall, wine and beer cellar, workshop, and in short, wherever business is transacted and money is exchanged for goods or labor." So there's that kind of dishonesty. What you just said, though, I wanted to pick up on a bit more. And I'm not sure I recall what that is.
You're not doing your best work?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, lack of full effort.
I think kind of with gossip, too, there can be cliques at work that either can have power with the administration or just within themselves.
Is that the way you spell
it?
Yes.
Yeah. It's mostly female oriented.
Does that fit your experience? Mm-hmm. No?
No.
You've seen it with men as well?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think there's a distinct difference. I do this for a living.
Do what for that?
I work in the workplace. I'm a career counselor. I'm a jobs. I train. I think there's a distinct difference between cliques with women and men. I think that men stick together when the chips are really down and protect each other, and I don't think women do it. Hmm. I think they're more competitive. I've done a lot of research and study with this and deal with women a lot. And I think women are more competitive, and we're not raised to support each other. If they're friends, it's different. Friendships are really different. But in a work environment, often, if a woman is promoted and starts to have the behaviors of management, and as a tough manager, it's the women, and there's a lot of research done. It's real interesting. And mm-hmm. that the men
tend to, certainly they can step all over each other, but it isn't as visible. They have more clubs together, and they'll stick together when the chips are down, more than women, particularly at a lower level.
Is it because of the fact that women have had to work a little harder lately to get up to those positions, and therefore the women who attain the manager positions are going to be a more ruthless person?
I think there's some of that, but I also feel strongly that women weren't raised in many ways, except in a Christian community or whatever. I mean, I don't think women were raised to support each other. I think they, even in school, women were, particularly older people, when you think about being young, you were going to get married and have kids, and the work world was, they didn't learn team sports, they didn't learn to be team players. They dressed to, we do a whole presentation on this, but there's a whole issue of women dress for other women to compete for men. I mean, I saw there's a workshop on advertising of women and the use of women in ads. It's just really fascinating, and you can see it in the workplace. You know, I'm a consultant, and people in the workplace are constantly telling me, can you train our female employees? It's just really, it's not, you know, I don't mean to say that every woman is like this by any means, but it's a barrier. It's definitely a barrier.
At the very least, it takes different shape than it does for men in touch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the strongest things, or one thing, is that forgetting that we make a difference in the workplace, forgetting that we have a call, no matter what that may be. It may be to make the perfect widget, but it may also be as a support to our other colleagues. And if we forget that, it takes everything out of work, and it makes it a job rather than make it a calling. And once you do that, then it's no fun anymore. You got to move on.
Yeah. But there are, I think, a whole lot of people who, you know, just kind of faced it on when they head to work and kind of just really endure that situation. I have a real hard time imagining doing that on a long-term basis. I've ended up changing jobs at various points because I couldn't do that to myself. But I think there are a lot of people who in fact...
because of fear, maybe because of other kinds of things.
Yeah. Were you going to comment, Terry?
Yeah, I was saying another one is work colleagues. I mean,
And there's, I don't know if you want to say more about that.
Well, I'm thinking of an executive director of entity that I'm involved with, and he is proud that he is the first person in and probably the last one to leave it. And so somebody else came in and is competing with him on that, and on weekends, and it's driving them nuts. And I keep thinking, well, you know, the job requirement is 40, 45 hours a week, you're doing about 75, 80. What are you getting out of it, you know?
Yeah.
And then that drives others, because, like, how do you keep up with a pile driver like that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, let's go, go, go. And so I think that's threatening. To spiritual health and the balance that we pray for.
I think there's a distinction that needs to be drawn a bit between workaholism, which is purely, in its pure form, is a clear addiction with poor self-esteem and poor social skills, and this is where I get my sense of who I am at all. And some job demands that are increasingly not just 40 to 45 hours a week, but you know, in certain careers or in certain firms, the expected 70 hours, at least as one is getting established in that situation. And I've been watching with some of the engaged couples that I work with. Now, it hasn't happened as dramatically lately, but I mean, I was seeing some people doing 14-hour work days and so on, and it's like, you know, and you're starting out in a relationship and you don't have any time for one another, where's it going to go from there? And, you know, a couple of people, they were both working in a supermarket, and it was clearly the expectation and would ease up some later, but it was going to involve a whole lot of their lives in a way that I was very concerned about, and they just sort of figured, well, if this is what we're going to do, this is what we've got to put in. So those are some real hazards too, but when it is in the individual's control, it's a real problem.
I have another thought.
Yes, please.
I think, listening to all this too, I think there's a whole another underlying piece here of how people communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
That is this kind of missing there, and that causes some of these barriers.
Mm-hmm.
Is the issue of styles of communication and styles of how
Definitely.
How people have their energy and keep their energy in and. You know, all of that, and make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That is a big piece
yeah.
of why some of these things occur and cause chaos in the workplace.
Uh-huh.
Is that people aren't sensitive to, they don't have time, and they're pressured, and they're not sensitive or haven't had an educational training as to the different styles
yes.
of how people function.
Yes. I have found, and this is a sweeping generalization, I realize, but, and so if it's not your experience, I would appreciate it if you'd say so. Any time that I've hit a place of conflict, especially in a work situation, it is because of a lack of clarity about job description, about what my expectation is versus the other's expectation, or single or plural. And so much, too, I think, is related to the skills question. You know, I deal with the skills more in terms of the interpersonal stuff with engaged and married folks, but it's, basically the same set of skills. And we are not trained in those skills, and it really shows up when we try and work with one another, sometimes in just really silly and crazy ways as far as, well, I thought you meant you were going to do it this way.
Unstated, though.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And,
not a verbal lot.
Yeah.
Right, and mm-hmm. it needs to be declared. I mean,
yeah.
It needs to be.
Yeah.
And it may be painful at times.
Well, and there are, as you're aware, I'm sure, a variety of kinds of schemes of looking at how people operate, whether, you know, how I operate for the most part, how I operate in a stressful situation, I can go to a different mode of operation, and all of that's important for me to know about myself, but for us to know about one another in terms of how we operate. How much closure do we need? How much can we operate in, you know, we'll kind of go see as we go sort of things.
I was thinking about one there, and it's revenge.
Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's very related.
Betrayal.
Pardon? And betrayal.
And betrayal.
Yeah. And it's related, too, to the cynicism thing that we were talking about before, whether that has to do with alienation. It can lead to a burnout. Why bother? Nobody's going to listen. Nobody really cares. All of that sort of thing. I don't know about you, but I just, I have down here a note, how many are familiar with the comic strip Dilbert? I don't find that funny very often at all. I just find it very grim. It's beyond my sense of humor, I guess. Another temptation too is an overly narrow focus, I think. I'll just do my job, just what I'm here for. I'm not going to worry about anybody else, anything else, you know, just kind of my piece of the pie and not a concern about how does that link in with others, what's happening with coworkers in it, you know, not an overly broad sense, but in a sense of being able to care about or notice others and how I'm part of a bigger picture.
And that's usually a survival skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To shift this a bit, we're still looking at some pretty negative things, but how does sin and evil fit in here? Let me suggest some possibilities and see what you think of these. Things like not using my gifts well in a job, or how poor self-esteem can relate to the job situation, issues of conflict, which are not of themselves evil or sinful, but when we don't have the skills or aren't clear with one another can become very harmful. Abuse potentials in a work setting, or over control. Any thoughts on those or other things related to that? Let me throw in something here. In my Christian marriage class, have used a lot in the last 2-3 years, Scott Peck's first book, The Road.
Let's travel.
I always forget whether it's Not Taken or Let's Travel, but anyway. And I just find it very intriguing, his suggestion in there, and I haven't read all of his subsequent books. I don't know if he gets into it more about sin being related to laziness and fear. And so, you know, if we name these kinds of things as some of the experiences of evil in a workplace, he means that we're not taking the energy to really do the work that relationships require. And, you know, there are very few people, I think, in a work environment that don't have some relational issues to deal with.
What is your definition of sin in the workplace, or what is your definition of that? You know, some people think sin is thinking that we are God, that we have the control,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that's where the control comes in. The other thing is, maybe sin is selfishness. We get that screwed up with self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when we do need self-care and see ourselves in the totality of things, you know, maybe other people would see it as not being mindful of that which is out there as well,
mm-hmm.
and not attending to others and other situations in the workplace too.
Mm-hmm.
Hard for me to.
Yeah. I'm not sure how I define it. Right off, I'm toying with the possibility of sin as a lack of balance. Because we talked about the need for balance in terms of spirituality. If I'm a boss and I'm very controlling and narrow, not tolerant of any different ideas and so on, there's a strength in that approach that's been overdone. Whereas the opposite lack of balance, that of being vague, of being wishy-washy, so on, would also, in a certain sense, be a way of sin or evil, because things weren't clear, they weren't, I don't know. I'm not sure that's tentative.
When you talk about balance too, which is something I train people that are unemployed, and one of the things, I liked what you were saying about the timber industry and the logging industry and this person, whatever they're doing with the glue. We try to teach from a spiritual point of view of the balance of the rest of your life other than just work,
mm-hmm.
and the skills that come from what else you do in life. And if you're a supervisor or a manager, the less control will happen if your life is balanced on the other side, outside of your job as well, so that not your whole being is thrust
mm-hmm.
into that mm-hmm. one job that you may be losing control over, which then ricochets.
Mm-hmm.
So we have them try to look at what other skills they have sure. in their life that they do sure. that can be transferred over
mm-hmm.
into another kind of job. Mm-hmm. Or encourage people, like he was saying, to, if you're working with glue or whatever you're doing with the logs, gain another skill through volunteer work or other aspects of your life that can be used as a backup.
Yeah.
I'm training people on welfare right now, and it's many of them are highly skilled and totally depressed
mm-hmm.
from domestic violence and other things, and they have lots of skills, and they don't have a balance. They do not have a balance.
Sure. Which would very much...
Their spiritual, physical...
Right,
and
right.
other parts of their life. It's all work.
Sure. Which would... that whole notion would... I can't think of the word I want. Work in terms of workaholism, but the connection I was making is you were,
it also applied. If you are working and that's it, and it's controlled by that, where's the other part of your life?
Yeah. But the other connection I was making as you were talking was I have identified it in terms of my work as a parent. When I get really controlling it on my kid's case, it's clear to me finally that I'm not taking care of me well.
Yeah.
And their rooms may be a mess, and they need to pick this up, but I'll approach it differently when I'm taking care of me well.
Yeah.
Which is the balance thing again. That's the connection I made.
Is there also a self-confidence and self-worth issue in that situation?
Which one?
The ones when you're dealing with the welfare and the abuse.
No, because I think, and I'm sorry I said welfare. I teach unemployed people. And actually that whole word is disappearing in it, starting July 1st. but I've also taught people that have been in senior management of corporations that have been laid off, and they're just as devastated as someone in low income, if not worse. So I think there's, all of us have that, or I shouldn't say the whole room, but as human beings, even for myself, I work really hard at, and I work for myself, which I thought was going to be a piece of cake, and I work harder than I ever have. And I wouldn't trade it right now, but boy, I work at that other balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find myself, when I'm out of balance, doing what you said. I mean, I just drive my employees. I mean, they haven't quit.
Yeah.
And we also happen to be a prayerful, spiritually driven company. We're not a religious organization, but it's part of us.
Yes.
But I didn't have to say, stop, come to Holden, you know, take a break.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true.
Yes.
Balance isn't just the balance of how you're dealing with your employees, but it's what you said.
Yeah.
It's the person.
Mm-hmm.
What else is in our lives? And we're a country that's very work-driven.
And there's some ways, I think, to get clues about that. I think this is a truism that most of you are probably aware of, but I think it's good to remind ourselves. When something irritates us in someone else, it's usually a clue that that's also the case in ourselves. And we can see it more clearly out there than we can in ourselves, and maybe something that we need to work on. Does that fit your experience?
Yes. Yeah. Except for lateness.
Oh.
Except for
not going to let me forget, are you?
No, that's not right.
Okay, I thought you were talking about me being late.
My wife is always late.
Oh, okay.
Is she late yet? She never had
an I love it.
It's usually, how can they get away with it when I couldn't? You know, how dare they? You know, the audacity of them doing that when I could never allow myself.
Well,
earlier someone spoke about living your mission, and it made me think. I was actually thinking of Scott Peck's title, "The World Less Traveled," before you brought it up, and how you know that is such a challenge. See, this is what I'm going to do, and embrace it. So as a young person, I personally did that, and now I have a friend who said something that resonated with me. He said an 18-year-old decided I was going to be a dentist. I'm 42, and I got to tell that 18-year-old to take this job and shove it, because I don't want to be a dentist any longer. You know, so it's that change, and we have life experience in that. It's to continue to live the mission as we grow.
Yes.
And that's what my friend is struggling with, and maybe I'm looking at that too. I don't know.
Well, and that's what I was going to shift on to, and we're just about out of time, I realize. But Peck's main point has to do with life is difficult, and he talks about four disciplines, and I think the question of discipline is an important one because it's related to spirituality. Not only do I need to work well in the time I'm given at a job, but also not to take work home with me so that we have a clear balance and energies for other things. How do I affirm and enable not only myself but others around me to be a place of positive energy in work setting? And the other thing that I wanted to just throw in here too is the need for prayer or mindfulness, however we're going to talk about that. And I think I raised that question the other day. How can we make explicit for ourselves that what we are about is a spiritual endeavor, or ask for God's presence or help in what we're about? Is it, you know, I say a particular prayer as I head to the office if my workplace is other than at home? Do I, you know, have some kind of reminder visually in my work setting? Do I think about prayer as I'm answering the phone, or how can I do that on a regular basis? I did notice in the bookstore, and I didn't have them set it with the stuff for this class, that there is a book on work and mindfulness out of the Zen tradition that looked pretty intriguing as I paged through it. But I don't know if anybody has anything they want to share real quickly that has helped them in terms of that practice or that reality. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
I've actually spent some days that I'm often on the phone, if I'm not recording it. And so in between each task, I actually get down on my knees and pray. Mm-hmm. It works. I'll usually stop sometime by middle of the afternoon, by 4 o'clock, I'm crazy. But till that point, of in between each task, to stop and pray and actually get on my knees,
wow.
It soothes me, uh-huh. and calms me, uh-huh. for the next event.
Yeah, yeah.
I work with chaos, and I pray a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's my business partner, I do silently. We contract with the state, so we have to be careful. But that's another issue that's a conflict for me, in the sense that when I was working in the workplace, there's a difference between evangelizing and sharing, you know, just speaking of what is your
experience.
Source of power.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether it's Buddhism or whatever it is, or whether it's God and the collective.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that is, that comes out in our classes without the two of us ever saying anything.
Sure.
I mean, everyone just at our graduations and in our time when I have to confront tough love with some of these people, I always pray before. And it makes, sometimes I forget, and when I'm tired, it makes a huge difference on how it comes across.
Mm-hmm.
Am I just this ogre that's telling them, you know, go get a job? Or, you know, I'm confronting them with their barriers. When I do it in prayer, it comes across, and I can be really tough, but it comes across much differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Much differently. And sometimes I'm ashamed that I don't talk about it more. I mean, I'm amazed I'm talking about it here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the talking about it may not be as necessary as, like you say, it comes across. It's very clear that that's the basis of who you are and how you operate. And I think that's the place that we want to get to, you know, whether I end up or feel the freedom to be articulate about that is another question. One of the thoughts that comes to my mind, I was in what I experienced to be a very stressful job that ended mid-May, and I knew for myself that in order for me to survive in that job this spring, I had to leave that environment at lunchtime and go do something for me. And it was a prayerful, you know, mindful experience, but it changed the energy and made all the difference in my being able to handle healthily that setting. And I think sometimes, you know, we can find ourselves in those kind of pressure cooker situations, maybe not with that freedom to do that. Well, thank you very much for the conversation. There's more that we could say, but I think we hit some of the points. If any of you are interested and able to join us tomorrow, what I'd ask you to do, if you can remember to do so, is to bring a symbol or more, if you have it, of your work with you. And if you don't have a symbol of your work with you, If you get a chance to just even, you know, sketch something out or whatever, we want to do some prayerful focus on God's presence in our work lives, kind of do what we were just talking about now in terms of how do we make those combinations and how do we really celebrate what we've been talking about this week together. So that's what the plan is for tomorrow. Thank you very much for the conversation.